Welcome everybody to the Aris Meyer podcast. How are you doing today? I have a very special guest today. He is the host of the Falling Out podcast. His name is Elgin Strait. How you doing, Elgin?
I'm doing great. Very, very happy to be here. Really happy to be having this conversation.
It's nice to see you, man. It's been a while. How are things over there across the pond?
Okay. We just started easing ourselves out of lockdown on Monday. So it's what? So Wednesday now? Today's Wednesday. Yeah. On Monday, we started easing ourselves out of lockdown. So went to the pub for the first time in a long time. Had a bit of a pub crawl. And yeah, it just feels like the world is kind of like opening up a bit over here, which is great.
Do you drink American beers or English beers?
So if I had a choice, I would drink English beers 100% of the time. The English beer is way better than American beer. It's way more flavorful. The beer making tradition here is like, 800 years old or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's great. The beer here is great. However, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, I developed an allergy to barley, which means I can't drink beer. And unfortunately I can't drink whiskey either. Damn. So I drink wine and tequila and rum now, basically.
Oh, all very
and gin
things.
And tonic. Yeah, exactly.
The perfect place for those.
Yeah, exactly. It's not bad, but I think Americans come here and any American who comes here, they go to a pub and they're like, why is this beer warm?
Yeah.
That's the one thing they always go back. They're like, the beer there sucks because it's warm. And it's like, well, okay, hold on a sec. What you're missing is like, talk about the flavor. Think about the flavor of the beer, because the beer here, if you talk about like ales and pale ales, they are so good here. There's so much flavor in them compared to, the piss y'all drink in America. So
whoa. Hey, these beers don't run. Okay. Coors Light is this next level.
Coors Light would just get laughed out of the park in this country. It's just like, no. Yeah.
I did. When I went to England, I had a Guinness and it was perfectly poured. It was so tasty. Yeah. But it was room temperature, which was weird to me.
Yeah.
Even Guinness here is like always kind of cold.
Yeah. So there are a lot of pubs here. They have Guinness served like the traditional temperature, mm-hmm. but then they have a second tap, which is Guinness extra cold, which is kind of like what you would expect in America, basically.
Yeah, I like that.
But I think you have to think about it. Like, the beer making tradition in this country, as I said, is, hundreds and hundreds of years old before refrigeration existed. So they were making beers that could last in, barrels in cellars of pubs, basically. And that's how it's been made, forever. And that's how a lot of them are still made, to keep in that context and to taste the best in that context, effectively. Yeah. So it's about the history, I would say.
Yeah, I guess so. All right. Well, obviously you have a very American voice, so you're not British. I was a guest on your podcast quite a few months ago. You started a podcast called the Falling Out podcast.
Yeah.
And I feel like you've been interviewing so many people and the people don't know who you are. So I want to do a podcast where mm-hmm. we find out who is this Elgin fella? Who's the wizard, who's behind the curtain?
Okay.
And like I said, you don't sound like you're English. So tell the people a little bit about where you're from, where you grew up.
Yeah, you're right. I'm not English. So I was born in the US. I was born in New York City. Surprise, surprise, Manhattan. I lived in the New Yorker Hotel, as did many other.
Shocking. Hold on. Many other,
I know, right? So I was born in New York. When I was about five, my parents and my family moved to Washington, D.C. My dad was one of the sort of first people to start working on the Washington Times. And he spent most of his career doing various things there at the Times. For that reason, when I was about five, my family moved to the DC area. I grew up in Maryland, so like DC, the DC metro area, effectively. So technically, I think I have a Maryland accent now. You know, if you were really like trying to place me, I still think the accent still exists. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I grew up there. I went to school there. And I went to university at University of Maryland, which is still in the DC metro area. And I moved to this country, England, in 2005. So that's like the 16 years ago now. Wow. So I've lived here for a long time. And that was like a year or two after I graduated university.
And you haven't started to sound English at all after all those years? You just
I have. This is my partially English voice.
Stop it. Come on, yeah. Bro. I've seen Downtown Abbey and all that. Come on.
No, it is. So the way I talk now, I used to have more of a sort of Maryland Southern drawl. Mm-hmm. But it's been softened. Even the way I say softened is I can tell it's changed. It's mm-hmm. it's like my vowels are longer and more drawn out, and I use words like properly and lovely, and like, because there's just certain things I say and the way I say them which is changed and softened.
Yeah.
But anyone I talk to over here is like, this,
they know immediately. I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like right exactly. away. When I went to visit England, like, there was not a single human being that thought I was not American. Mm. Like, just looking at me, they were like, come on, bro. It's like, it's not even a question, dude. And I was just like, I felt like such a dumb American. Like, I would buy some and I just have the money in my hand, like, take the money out of my hand. I don't know how much that is.
So I felt like that for probably 2 years after moving here. Mm-hmm. Maybe three, I don't know exactly, but I feel like after living here for a couple years, then I was like, I felt like I kind of fit in a bit. Yeah. Like, I didn't feel like the idiot walking in the store and being like, how does the money work? And I just kind of like understood it a bit better. People would still, like, the way I talk would still, you know, definitely mark me as an American, but I just kind of felt like I understood it better. I kind of got how things worked, but it took me a while. And there's still things about English culture that I'm still learning. And like that I didn't appreciate even in the first few years, but I'm still learning it now, basically.
And English, man. So let's go back to your childhood. So your dad worked for the Washington Times.
Yeah.
So you must have been pretty plugged into the church community then. Like, were you pretty involved in going to church and doing like events and
that? Yeah, kind of stuff? I mean, yeah, my family went to church every weekend. So we would drive from my parents' house in Maryland to the main church in DC, which is the one that used to be a Mormon church, but then was bought by the Unification Church.
Yeah. I've been there before. It actually is like a church.
Yeah. It's pretty unusual. Cause I remember when we were talking, like, you were talking about going to church at someone's house. And yeah. I know that that's like quite common, but I think in the overall context of the Unification Church in the US, like, there are very few places where they actually have a church building.
Yeah.
And Washington DC is one of them. I think it's hilarious that they bought it from the Mormons, by the way. you probably don't know the DC area, like, obviously as well as I do, but basically the Mormons had this church in downtown DC. I think they sold it in the 70s or the 80s to the Unification Church, but they basically like upgraded. So they sold that and they created this church. And it's like, it's really strategically located along the beltway. So that the beltway that goes around the DC area, gets like just a ton of traffic. It's like one of the major like ways around the city. There's one place where you basically, all those cars coming on the highway, they're all going over this hill. And you know what they see when they come over the hill?
The big LDS.
They see this big gleaming white building with gold spires on top. And that is the new Mormon church, like, strategically placed in that specific location.
The Unification Church likes to be a little more camouflaged. We like to buy buildings in the 80s and then not renovate them for 40 years.
And I'm sure, I mean, this thing is like pristine white. These guys, they must spend a fortune and do a great job on just the upkeep of a building like that, because it looks amazing.
It's
like literally white with gold spires, and it's very strategically placed. I went to that church, like, you know, almost every Sunday of my childhood, effectively, I would say. I went there, and we would, sometimes I would go and go to friends' houses afterwards, go to church in the morning, in the afternoons we'd like go to my friend's house, my parents would pick me up in the evening, that sort of stuff. I actually had a lot of fun playing with kids there, and I made some good friends. And then, we were definitely steeped in kind of all the other stuff that was happening with the church in the DC area. So, there would be speaking tours, and we go to whatever hotel that the Reverend and Moon and his wife and his kids or whatever were speaking at, we'd go there, and they were just all, I don't know what it's like in LA where you grew up, but there's just kind of always stuff happening. Whether it's a speaking tour, or it's some holy day and everyone has to get up at 5 a.m. and go down to the church. And then they were trying to, during spring breaks from school or summer breaks, they would try and have especially when we were younger, I'm not talking about the sleepaway camps, but they would in the DC area, in the DC church, they might try and have almost a day camp for kids for a week in Easter break or something like that. So
yeah,
I was there a lot. Exactly. Oh yeah. It's you might have a day off school, and then they would try and organize a little mini workshop where you sleep away somewhere for a night. Like that just happened countless times throughout my childhood. I can't even remember how many times.
So you were pretty plugged into the community. I mean, you grew up, were your school friends also church kids, or were?
No way. So
double life.
Yeah. I would say I had a double life. The schools that I went to never had any Moonies in them, with some rare exceptions. Actually when I went to high school, there were a couple in older grades. But we're talking in a school of between 2,000 and 3,000 kids. I was one, and then there were two other ones and they weren't even in my grade. So it was very small, and we would kind of say hi in the hallways and stuff. It wasn't like we tried to hide the fact that we knew each other, but we never really hung out, and no one ever asked a question of how do you know these people? So it was definitely there were different crews. Definitely. I would say. And then the thing is the DC church, it drew people from all across the DC area. So when I went to church, there were kids from Virginia, there were kids from other counties in Maryland. And so they were the ones that became my friends at church. But then when I went, to school, there were just only kids from my county there, basically. And so there just weren't any other many Moonies to pull from in that context.
So I'm sure the people want to know, Elgin, yeah. My friend Elgin is a very white man, very pale, got some blue eyes, I think.
What
did you tell the friends that came over and saw the pictures of Reverend Moon and his wife all over your house? What was your go-to line?
Dude, I just ignored it. and I hope they ignored it. And no one ever. So it's a great question. No one ever asked me about it directly, to my face.
Really?
In the moment, no one ever asked me about it to my face. But there were times, I remember at least one time where a friend of mine, and we weren't great friends, but it was something we were going to a mutual friend's birthday party, and my parents gave us both a ride home, and he stopped at my house for a bit before his parents came and picked him up from my house. We weren't hanging out, but it was just in my house for 15 minutes or something like that before his parents came over. And we had, we had the photos, and we had these, do you remember what was it called? Ambassadors for Peace. Mm-hmm. Do you remember Ambassadors for Peace?
Oh, yeah.
Where you could get a plaque that was you're our ambassador for peace.
And I was one, dog. Yes. In high school, I think.
Congrats. You should be proud.
Certificate, son.
Hold on. Let's come back to this, to that. Cause I got a stupid story on that. But, So anyway, this guy came to my house and he saw some of the, you know, Mooney paraphernalia, whatever it was. And then like a couple of days later in school, he was like, "Can I ask you a question?" He was like, "Are you a Mooney?" And I was like,
"Oh, so he knew who that was."
He knew. Yeah. Yeah. He knew. And actually, and I have to say, like, so even though my school wasn't in a particularly Mooney area, kids were really clued up. Some kids were really clued up, and part of it was like the Washington Times was you know a paper that was known in the area, and I also like I guess the other thing is so I went to a high school they call it a magnet high school where I was from, so it was like a advanced math science and computer science program. And the kids were really fucking smart that I went to school with. I honestly, like, they were like, they all like went to Harvard and shit like that. Like they were really fucking smart. So imagine these really like smart, precocious kids. They probably read a shitload of newspapers and stuff like that. They're just like, I guess I just want to paint a picture of like, I think these kids were just more clued up about stuff than your average high schooler. But so you couple that with like going to, also living in a metro area where the Washington Times is and people being aware of it. So actually one, I think I mentioned this when I spoke to Akina, I'm not sure, but he's actually one of my best friends now, but he came, we were talking in school and he was like, he asked me where my parents worked. We were just like chatting and I told him my parents worked at the Washington Times. And he was like, "Do you know who owns the Washington Times?" And I was like, "No, who owns it?" So I just tried to play dumb, right? And I forget exactly what he said, but I mean, so he didn't have any knowledge of me or anything like at that point. Now he knows it. He knows the whole story and he's a good friend of mine. But at that point he didn't, but I guess all this is to say, so there's at least two incidents there of like just kids I went to school with kind of like knowing what the church was without, you know, just because they were, you know, aware of it because they were living in the DC area and had read about it or whatever. And I'm sure other ones knew about the church, whether or not they knew about me is another story, but they were aware of it. And this was like, both of those happened, I would say when I was like 16, 17 years old, basically.
That's wild. I mean, yeah, living in Southern California, all my friends would come over and nobody knew what it was.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no Unification Church presence in Southern California on like a large scale.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they would always just be like, and you know, these are like white, black, Latino kids. I didn't really have any Asian friends growing up. There were very few Asians in South Orange County at the time where I lived in San Clemente. And my friends would just come over and be like, "Dude, who are these? Why do you have pictures of these old Chinese people all over your house?" It was mad wild because there was pictures of like, it was the famous one where she's in the gold dress and he's like in a suit. And then there's ones all over the house of like they're fishing. And then they got you know, we would have a picture of like their kids, like the one that died that did all the coke and some other ones.
Yeah.
And then my dad also had like a picture that he got like a postcard of the Bush family, like George W. Bush, like his family. So people would come in my house and be like, "There's no pictures of you. Who the fuck are these?" Like, you got mad pictures of, and I'd be like, "Oh, I don't know. You know, I'll just make up some bullshit." Like,
exactly. Same thing.
They came with the frames or like those people used to live here. Like, I don't, it was just all.
Yeah.
Cause I had no, what do you say?
I don't know.
When there's no pictures of your own family and there's pictures of all these random Asian people, and you're just like, I don't know.
How did no one ask me that question? I don't know. I think it was kind of like, so my parents had this like wall of photos that was pretty much our whole family. So that we kind of like had that covered. It was like, we had more photos of my family than of the Moon family. So at least it kind of like checked out in that regard.
Yeah.
But then there were just a few like strategically placed Moon family photos. One was in the altar. I mean, who the fuck has an altar?
Yeah.
Let alone
that's
an altar with this Korean family. But yes, we had that. And then we had this photo. I remember it was in our dining room. And we had sort of like a display cabinet in the dining room, and on top of it, looking down over the dining room table, was this portrait, this photo of like the entire Moon family. Like we're talking like Moon, his wife, like all their kids, all their grandkids, like everyone. There are like 50 people in this photo, and they're all just like standing,
I remember those
standing
kind
there,
of pictures.
Standing there wearing suits, right?
Yeah.
And like with obviously like, you know, Reverend Moon like in the center. And like that was that. So they were just watching us eat all the time.
Did you have their picture in your wallet?
I did.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Here's the rare Pokemon card though. Did you have the gold Chunilguk membership card?
No, I didn't have that. So I remember talking to people about that. I feel like it's kind of like had sort of left before that was a thing.
Yeah.
It didn't quite like rise to prominence during my time in the group. But I kind of knew of it. Basically. So you had one? What did it have like your one. Photo? Like a passport?
Dog, not only did it have my photo and my information, it had a barcode in the back. And I don't know what the fuck that barcode was for. Like when you go to heaven, do they scan you in? Like I was like, well, I don't know what this barcode is, but I used to wild out with that thing. Like when people would ask for my ID and stuff, just being a fool, I would like hand it to them. Because there's nothing, literally nothing to do with it. You can't. I don't even know what it's
worthless.
For.
Like, it's a worthless piece of paper.
Yeah, completely worthless. And I remember one time, I mean, this podcast is about you, but I remember one time
I got
fundraised to like by these two girls. And they were from, there was like in LA, there was like the main church. And then there was like a couple Japanese side churches doing their own thing.
Yeah.
With just Japanese members.
Yeah. We had that in DC. I feel like there was like a Japanese one and a Korean one and stuff. Yeah. Like, yeah.
So there's these two girls. I think I was in Venice, and they were like trying to give me the spiel, you know. And they had like a tchotchke box with a bunch of stuff, and they were like, "Yeah, this school in Africa, whoop de whoop." And then they opened the box, and there was the picture of two parents. So I was like, "Son, come on!" But I just was like, so they were like giving me their whole spiel, and I was like, let me, you know what? Do you guys take credit card? And they were like, no. And I was like, oh man. So I was like, opened my wallet, and I was kind of looking through to pretend I was gonna buy something. And then I took out that card and I handed it to him. I was like, oh, do you guys take this? And then she looked at it. And she was like so sleep deprived, I could tell. She looked at it and she looked at me and she handed it to me and just went to the next table. She didn't even acknowledge. She
wasn't even like, oh my God, you're one of us.
No, her brain did the math like, oh, this is church person. No money to be made. Next table. It was wild. Man,
that's fucking crazy.
It was wild, bro. But that's the only time I ever used it.
Yeah. I remember this one time when I was a kid, somewhere maybe like between 10 and 13, 14 years old. And I guess this just shows like kind of how out of touch I think we all were. So we're just like sitting in my house. I think it was like a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday afternoon. And like this, like either Japanese or Korean, like young man, just like walks up to our house and rings a doorbell. And my dad sees him coming and sees him about to ring the doorbell. And he's like, oh, I think he's one of us. And I was like, I remember. And then he goes and like, he kind of talks to the guy and he leaves the guy at the door. And then he comes back and like talks to my family. And I was like, and he's like, he comes back and he's like, yeah, he's one of us. And I was like, dad, how did you know? Like, I had this concept that like, it was normal just to be out, like knocking door to door. Like it could be any of like thousands of groups that would be like, you know, this like, you know, Asian person who like, you know, clearly like did not speak English, like just going door to door. I was like, oh, there must be like, that's just a normal thing. Yeah,
everybody
like, many
does
groups.
That.
Everybody does that. I just thought, but my dad was like, nah, man, he's like, I was right. He's one of us. Let's bring him in. Let's like, you know, give him some tea or whatever. So this Japanese guy came, he looked like he was like, I don't know, maybe around 20 years old. He came in and we like had tea or coffee or whatever. And my parents like, you know, welcomed him into the house. But I remember that was a really weird moment growing up where like, I sort of thought everything we were doing was normal. But then my dad in being like, oh my God, he's one of us. Mm-hmm. It sort of like alluded to the fact that like, actually this shit wasn't normal.
Yeah.
And I feel like in a way that kind of like, that was kind of like a piece of sort of like, you know, pulling back the curtain basically. It was like, wait, hold on. Maybe this isn't normal.
Dude, I remember. All right. We'll get to your life after this. Hold on. One more.
Yeah, no,
I remember, speaking of not normal. in our living room, my dad bought a big ass whiteboard, like with markers, so he could like do like church presentations and shit. You know, like on Sundays when we didn't go to church. And I remember we would get like Jehovah's Witnesses and stuff, you know, how they would just canvas neighborhoods or Mormons. My dad could not wait for them to come visit so he could invite them down and start lecturing to them. And I remember like so many times just walking out of my room and seeing these like horrified looks on their faces as they're like sitting there with coffee and my dad's up at the whiteboard like, it's like Unification Church jujitsu. Like, oh, you thought you were going to convert me? Like, psych.
Surprise, motherfuckers.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure they like took us off the route. Like, they must have like blacked out our house on the map, you know?
Oh, that's man, that's hilarious. Yeah, but no, I feel like that's like every. I mean, like, I saw that with my parents as well. I feel like any Moony parent, they cannot resist the temptation of someone from another faith knocking on their door.
They're like
I'm ready, come on in, let's have this conversation.
Okay as a white person too, this is unique to us too, I think. Could your parents resist when they met an Asian person, especially a Korean? Could your parents resist saying annyeonghaseyo, kamsahamnida, or moon samyung every time, right? As like, dude, they just, it was their favorite thing.
Dude, going to like a Korean restaurant was so embarrassing.
Bro, always embarrassing.
It was so embarrassing. I mean, just going to a restaurant in general was embarrassing with my family when they would like pray and like real fucking loud. And with like the, I mean, that's weird in general, but then when they end it with like, I pray in my name, you know, blah, 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 of a blessed central family. Like, that shit was fucking weird. And then you do that in a goddamn like Korean restaurant, trying to do it in Korean. What the fuck? After you've already said, given your, you know, annyeonghaseyos and shit. Jesus Christ.
Just so embarrassing. All right. beyond
embarrassing.
All right. So Elgin, you went to a normal high school in Maryland.
Yeah.
And then after you went to high school, did you go to STF? Or did you go straight to college?
I didn't do STF. I went to uni. I went to university.
You're a bit older than me. I'm 83. What year?
I'm 81. I was born in 81. Yeah.
So my year of STF was the first year that Hyunjin took over, H1, who's like Mr. Elvis. Yeah. So before that,
I remember that guy.
I don't know what it was like.
Give you a bit of a feel. So my older sister went. And I knew some guys who were like a year or two older than me who were on STF, and they came to like the they like basically lived in the DC area, and I kind of like I got to know them. Like, I would see them at church reasonably frequently during that like year that they overlapped, and it was this you know, all the like the fundraising and the witnessing. Sorry, do we need to like explain what STF is, or are we past that? Okay. All right.
Whatever you want.
Okay.
Brother.
Okay. All right. But I guess a couple things. Number one, I my sister had been there, and I kind of like talked to her a bit about it, and it just didn't seem like that great of an experience. And I think this is before it kind of got like way more hardcore, because I think the guy that you're talking about kind of like really.
Ours was mad hardcore.
So
7 days a week we had took a shower maybe twice, like
no, so I think in the year or two before then, I think it was a little more like relaxed, like it kind of, I got the, it felt almost like a kind of like small town family vibe type of thing. So I think less hardcore than what you're describing. But I guess a couple things. So number one, I talked to my sister. It didn't seem like that amazing as an experience. But also, so the way, basically, I went to this high school in Maryland, and a lot of my friends were going to the University of Maryland, like, just cause like it was, so some of them went to like Harvard and like all these places like that, but a lot of them ended up going to the University of Maryland, because University of Maryland actually has like, it's actually very good academically. And if you're good going in, you could actually get like a pretty good scholarship. So a lot of my friends, like they kind of looked at it and they did the math and like, actually, I'm just going to go to Maryland. It's like down the road and like, I'll get scholarship basically. So I was just thinking about the dynamic of that, of like taking a year off, like, you know, and actually a lot of these people I've known them from through middle school and high school. So I known them for like 6 years. And I was just thinking of like, it would be nice to keep that like same social circle when I go into university, and not like have this year gap basically. So yeah. I was just kind of thinking about that dynamic. And I was like, I don't think I want to go to STF. I just want to like, keep going, like go to university, like keep in touch with these people and not have this, like this weird gap. Cause I actually did have that gap when I went to Korea, when I was 13, 14 for the GOP program. But I didn't want to do that again, basically. I wanted to, and like I said, like some of the people are like still some of my best friends to this day. So I just didn't want to have that gap in that connection. So I ended up just, going to university. Yeah.
Did you feel pressured by the community to go to STF, or you didn't feel, it just didn't matter?
I feel like my parents, thankfully my parents didn't pressure me one way or the other. The community, I felt a bit like it, but I feel like this was, in a way, I feel like the years before me, they were almost like experimental years. Like the idea of this, like sort of like course that you were supposed to go on, if you had like grown up in the movement, it hadn't quite developed. It hadn't quite solidified. There wasn't this idea that like, this is the path you have to go on. It was for the few years before me and maybe ending right with me. It was kind of like, this is a thing that we're trying with our kids. Like, let's kind of see how it goes. So it kind of felt like an option as opposed to an expectation, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then I think in the subsequent years, that's when it started becoming more of an expectation, basically.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. So you went to university, college, as we call it in America.
Yeah.
When did you move to England and why?
Good questions. There's a lot behind that. So mentally I'd left the church when I was 18. Mm-hmm. But I still obviously had all the community and family ties. And when I, and I'll get to the England bit in a second, but this is kind of just setting the foundation for that. So when I was graduating university, I guess a couple of things. Number one, I was thinking of doing, I didn't want to just start working, because I kind of felt like I could always do that later on. Like if I wanted like go travel or do something different, like now is the time to do it, because mm-hmm. the working world will always be there. So I came up with this goal. I wanted to live on every continent by the age of 30. And I'd actually done a semester abroad in Australia. And I lived in Korea when I was 13 or 14. Obviously, I grew up in America. So that left three more: South America, Africa, and Europe. I'm excluding Antarctica from this equation, by the way.
That's messed up, dude.
And I was like, all right, well, okay. Africa is going to be the hardest, so let me try and do that one first. So I was thinking about it, and I knew a guy who was like a youth leader in the DC area for a long time. He'd been a youth leader for a long time. And so I would like go and like do sleepovers at his house and stuff when I was way younger. But anyway, at some point he went and started an NGO, supposed NGO called IRFF, International Relief Friendship Foundation. He went and started their chapter in Cameroon in West Africa. And he was kind of like, he was someone that I knew, like I knew him well, like growing up. And so I, in the run up to me graduating, I contacted him and I said, hey, I'm graduating. Like, I just want to like do something different. Would it be okay if I come and just like help you out for like 6 months. And he was like, sure, just buy a plane ticket and I got a place for you. So I was like, all right, sweet. Okay. So that's what I did. I bought a plane ticket, moved to Africa. And lived in Cameroon, which, I mean, that was a crazy experience. Like, yeah, there's a lot of crazy shit happened there. but when I was there, that's, when I met, the person that became my wife and then ex-wife. So her family was effectively doing missionary work there in Cameroon. So I kind of like got to know their whole family. And then our parents started talking and started like suggesting that we get matched and all the rest, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, so they were church people. They weren't like Christians.
They were church people. Yeah, no, they were church people. They were church people. You know, tale as old as time. The parents start talking, and they
of course, yeah.
Anyway, so I got matched to this woman her mother was from England, and as a result of that, I ended up. So that was in 2003 when I was in Africa, and then in 2005. Like I moved back to the US, she moved back to England, but in 2005 I moved here, we got married. And that's what brought me here.
Okay.
Was that basically.
Yeah. Did you get blessed, married in the Unification Church, or did you just get regular married?
Yeah, no, we got blessed in the Unification Church and married. Okay. We got blessed and then married 2 days later. We had like a proper church wedding, basically. Okay.
So you had said earlier that you kind of left the church at 18. Was it like ceremonial just to get blessed, or were you both kind of believers, or what was the dynamic?
It was ceremonial. It was both of us. We both kind of like got to a point. I don't necessarily want to like put words in her mouth, but I would say like broadly speaking, we both had similar views that like this church is bullshit. But we both see the value in being together for the sake of kind of keeping our families happy. And we think we can make this work between us. I saw a lot of good in her. I still see a lot of good in her. And I would hope she would say the same thing about me. But we both thought about it, and it was like, yeah, there's a lot good here that we can see in each other. We can probably make this work. And if we can make it work, then like, our families will be happy, and we can just like, it's kind of like everyone wins if we can make this work, basically. So that was broadly speaking, our thought process on both sides.
Yeah. And I'm sure you were happy to knock another continent out. So England was.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, it's all lining up. Like I'm moving to England. It's all lining up.
Yeah.
So yeah, it all kind of like it fit that trajectory in a way.
When you moved to England, did you kind of start mixing in with the Unification Church in England? Because when I visited, I went to quite a few different church properties and met church people, mm-hmm. and you know, there's a very big community.
Yeah, there was a big community, and I mean, yeah, I would say, when I first moved here, I lived like an hour or two outside of London, and so there weren't a lot of people close, but. Excuse me, within a year or two of moving, I actually moved into London, and I moved into this property that the church owns. Excuse me, you've probably been there in Lancaster Gate. Mm-hmm. And there's a bunch of, at the time, I don't know about now, but at the time, there were a lot of like second gen who are kind of like in various stages of leaving, but who still like lived in that building, basically. And myself and my ex-wife were one of them. And so we got to know like a lot of other people that lived there, and we got to become quite good friends with a lot of them, and as well as some other people that were, you know, they were friends with as well. So, I'm like very fortunate to say that, I've actually developed some really good friendships with all those people. None of them are in the church anymore. Yeah. They're all like, you know, fuck you, but
I mean,
but we all share a very deep connection, I would say, as a result of kind of like coming from that same place. And like some of us lived together, some of us didn't, but we all kind of like became friends basically. So
yeah,
the ex church community here has become a pretty strong support network for me.
When I went to England and I went to the different properties, we went to Lancaster Gate, and I heard somebody told me that the youngest Moon daughter lives there, the one that was on the reality TV show.
Yeah.
So she lives there.
She lived there when I was there. She lived on one of the top floors. It's like imagine these old buildings that probably used to like hold like a single family back in the day, but like they had a fucking ballroom in there and shit. Like it was like a ridiculous place.
There's buildings like that in like New York, like the whole level of the building will be somebody's home.
Exactly. But over time it's been like split up into more and more like subdivided apartments basically. But on one of the floors they kept a floor for her. She goes by Cat Moon. I don't know like what she's doing now or if she still lives there, but she lived there when I was there. So we were like see her kind of like going in and out of the building every now and then. I never really talked to her, but she was there.
Mad weird that like there was a Moon person, or were you just like, oh, that's
It was weird. Living in that building was weird because like you would wake up on like a Sunday morning and like they'd be like singing, you know, Glorious the Song. like whatever, you'd hear it kind of like, you know, just circulating through the windows. And there were times when we didn't even want to leave our apartment on a Sunday because we were like, who knows who we're going to see in the hallway.
Yeah, just mad people.
And they're going to be like, oh, why aren't you doing this? Or, you know, how are your parents or whatever? It's like, fuck.
Did you start family, a.k.a. have you had sex yet? Hi, I'm random 60-year-old weird dude.
I want to know if you've had sex yet. I thought you were legitimately like asking me that question. No, I didn't.
No, bro. What the? You're so conditioned to answer that question. Yes, I have started family. It is great.
That's so weird, right? That's a thing that people would ask. But exactly. Oh, how you started family life?
Some dude that you've never talked to your entire life.
Yeah,
I want to know if you're fucking.
Yeah. Fuck Jesus Christ. But
I have a question actually about.
Okay.
So you're in the building and Cat Moon's there.
Yeah.
Since your father worked for Washington Times when you were a kid. Mm-hmm. Did you ever have any personal experiences with the Moons or with any like high profile people? Your dad sounds like he was like ground level Washington Times.
Yeah. I would say a few. So I talked about this when I did the interview with Teddy Hoes, but I was in the room at the Washington Times 10-year anniversary. And Moon was there. With his wife and I'm sure some of his kids and stuff. And they had this these videos of congratulations from, I think it was like Reagan and Bush and some other like big wigs in the Republican Party. So I was there at that banquet at the Washington Times. Also, I'm just thinking back on that. I remember it was like a big deal. It was held in like the Washington Times banquet room. Mm-hmm. Like, why does a newspaper need a fucking banquet room? just saying. Like, I don't think any other newspaper has a fucking banquet room. Like, it's just fucking weird. But anyway, like, they had, like, a room for that. And it was, like, a black tie affair. So I was, like, I was young. I was probably, like, 8 or 10 years old or something like that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. When that happened.
Did the crowd go crazy? Like, Reagan. No way, no. It's Reagan. Like, were they all like super excited?
No, not really. But and just to be clear, Reagan wasn't there. It was a video. It was video recording from Reagan. But no, the weird thing was in that room, I could tell there was a dynamic of like all the Moonies were like mesmerized by Moon. Mm-hmm. And everyone else was just like, this guy is weird as fuck. That was the dynamic in the room at the time. And I think you can watch on YouTube like some videos of that. I was there. I also went to like untold number of like speaking tours, Women's Federation for World Peace, Family Federation for World Peace and Unification, Lord knows what, and like, you know, Hak Ja Han would come in and like give speech or whatever, like I just untold numbers of those. Trying to think the other experience that really comes to mind, and again I mentioned this when I interviewed Teddy, was going to Camp Sunrise. I think I would have been 14 or 15, and Sean Moon was there.
Mm-hmm. And that's Gungeonim?
Gungeonim.
Bullet yeah. Crown Pee Wee Herman.
Bullet Crown Pee Wee Herman. Yeah. So he was yeah. there.
You know, he's and a he biker now. He's got a Harley and a motorcycle gang.
Okay. Well, that doesn't surprise me.
every Buddhist's dream.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So he was there along with his brother, Philip, who's the one who later committed suicide. Okay. And basically, I mean, there were a couple hundred kids at this workshop. These two, like Sean and Philip, were like definitely like kind of, the whole workshop was kind of like walking on eggshells around them, because they're yeah. like, oh my God, these are like the true children. We can't like, you know, like we got to like treat them with respect and blah, blah, blah. But Sean Moon was a complete fucking asshole. He would get in fights with kids. He would just completely mistreat them physically, verbally, emotionally, anything. You name it. He was just a fucking asshole. His brother Philip was super nice. I to this day, I have a lot of respect for him, because he just seemed like a really like good, like gentle guy, like a guy like you would, he might be kind of quiet, but like you would enjoy his company in a way that like Sean Moon, you'd be like, oh, what the fuck, this guy is like gross. Like, uh-huh. you know, like, so they were both there at that camp. And, yeah, just, I mean, I just, I'll never forget the day when one of this older BC was basically, he was kind of like giving his testimony in front of the whole workshop. And he talked about how, like, he was trying to legitimately show compassion for all these younger kids. And he was talking about how like he was blessed now, but he was talking about how when he was a kid, he used to look at porno mags. And I remember he specifically said, like, yeah, I used to hide them like behind the toilet where I didn't think anyone could find them. Uh-huh. It was either like behind the toilet, or I might be getting this detail wrong. He would like put them in a Ziploc bag and put them inside the water tank in the toilet.
That's which is next fucking level,
sweet.
Dude.
It's fucking That's next sweet. Level. It might have been, it was one of those, but like, I just remember he was kind of talking about, and he's like, look, you know, like, he was kind of trying to say it without saying it. Like, everyone has these urges. Like, it's okay.
Yeah.
That's sort of what he was trying to say. Like, have some compassion for these kids. And Sean Moon just gets up and starts fucking screaming at him. He just starts screaming at him, saying like, how dare you disrespect, like, you know, the legacy of my father? How dare you, just like all this crazy shit. And so it's this like electrifying moment where this like BC is like, you know, standing on stage. There's like hundreds of us kids and teenagers standing around. Sean Moon has stood up as well. Everyone else is sitting down. Mm-hmm. And these two guys are just like yelling at each other for like 30 or 40 minutes. And neither will back down, basically. Uh-huh. And I give this guy credit to like this older second generation, because he put Sean Moon in his motherfucking place. I will bow down. I have immense respect for that guy for the rest of my life. Like, I will always remember that moment mm-hmm. of him just like standing up for me and for everyone else in that room against this fucking tyrant of a man.
Shithead.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, what's funny is he probably tells his congregation now, like, you know, if you got a handgun, you can put it behind the toilet, or you can put it in the toilet. And he just stole all boys' spots, bro.
Just like, yeah.
If you got handguns,
that's where you should hide it. Put it in a Ziploc bag. Boom.
Yeah, it's funny how there's like this disconnect where we have like a way that we've been taught to look at the Moons and their kids, and then once you meet them in person, it either, you know, affirms it, or you have to like pretend like you didn't really find out who they are. Like, I used to have to do security when Reverend Moon would come to LA. The local church uncle would get like a bunch of dudes to be like hotel security, pretty much.
Yeah.
Walk him through the building and then stand in front of his room at night. I mean, fucking nobody ever came, because no one gives a shit about him.
Yeah, I remember.
As like a high schooler, I felt like important, like he's right there in that room. But you would kind of see like the behind the scenes of how the Moon kids really were. Because in LA, we have no contact with them. Our only contact is when they come for speeches. Otherwise, we like live in a different world. So I'd be standing in front of his room, and him and his wife would walk by, and then the kids would walk by, and sometimes they would talk to you and sometimes they wouldn't. And I remember talking to Gunny Shoot Shoot Boom Boom. He had this big, like, this back when he was like right after being a Buddhist, he had this phase where he was a unificationist, and he had this big like platinum chain.
Oh, the gold. Yeah. 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 Like big ass, emblem.
Like, like he thought he was 50 Cent or some shit, but like,
yeah, I mean, exactly. Anyway.
Yeah. But I just remember like rapping with him a little bit and talking to him and just thinking like, dude, this guy's a douche. Like,
he is such a douche. Oh, actually I have another story about that guy. So, back when I was living in Lancaster Gate, he did a speaking tour. And so this may not be like widely known, but, Reverend Moon was banned from coming to the UK for a long time.
I remember hearing that.
Yeah. And I think it was like his wife could come, but he couldn't. And as a result, it was like a big deal if anyone from his family ever came to this country. And when I was living in Lancaster Gate, Sean Moon was he was going on a speaking tour and like coming to London.
Is this when he was bald head in a strawberry?
Like, yeah, this is back when he was trying to be Buddhist. He came, I remember it was like a fucking big deal for all the church members, right? Like, and my ex-wife and I were like, whatever, dude. Like, but her parents were insistent. They were like begging us to go to this thing. And we were like, all right, fine. We'll go. So we go, and it was actually walking distance from where we lived. So we had to like walk across Hyde Park to, I think it was in Kensington, like Old Town Hall or something. It was in like a pretty cool place. So we went there and like, it was like, I mean, we hadn't been to one of these things in like probably 10 years, but we go and you know how like they have these, like, they play these videos. Mm-hmm. Where they have the guy with like the movie announcer voice saying like, and this is the course that they went through to save humanity, blah, 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 blah.
Yep.
So they're like playing that video and I'm just looking at my ex-wife and we're just like rolling our eyes. We're like, what the fuck is this? This is so dumb. And then it goes through, like they play the video. He has a speech. He's an idiot. Afterwards, you could like, you could line up to get in a photo with him.
Yeah.
And my ex-wife's parents like grab her and grab me and they're like, mute us in like 5 minutes. We're going to get in line. We have to get in a photo with this guy. And we're like, okay, whatever. And so they go, I think they're like, you know, we'll save you a place in line, but you have to be there in line with us. Like, we just there in 5 minutes or something like that. So they go like wait in line. And they leave me and my ex, and I look at her, I'm like, I'm not getting that fucking photo. And she's like, you motherfucker, you better not fucking leave me here. I was like, no, I can't do it. I'm not getting that motherfucking photo.
Yeah.
And so she was so fucking mad at me, but she went and got in line.
No, so it was just
and I just like, so it was just the three of, it was her parents and her.
Oh,
and I just left
God.
The building. I just left the building.
Damn. That's fucked up, dude.
And, yeah. And then they went, like they got their photos, and I saw the photo later and it was like, they all had to do this kind of like heart emoji with their hand in the photo. Yeah. It was uber cringe. But I just remember I had like the most awkward lunch afterwards with my ex-wife and her parents, where we went and like, we went to a cafe nearby and we're like having lunch. And it was like, they were just so unhappy with me for the fact that I didn't want to be in that photo. And they kept asking me questions like, why didn't you want to be in it? Like, and I was just like, he's just not a good person. Mm-hmm. Like, I can just tell that. And I guess maybe they didn't know everything. Like the fact that I had met him over 10 years earlier when he was a fucking asshole.
Yeah.
But I was like, no, man, like considering, like I met him 10 years over 10 years ago, he was a fucking asshole then, fucking asshole now. Like, I'm sorry, I don't want to be in a fucking photo with him.
Yeah.
And I tried to explain that to them, like probably didn't use those exact words, but like it was a very, very, very awkward lunch. And then later, I saw the photo on their wall in their house.
Did they like? Did they add you in the photo? Like yeah. just like cut out,
like copy and paste?
Yeah.
No, they didn't. But I honestly think like my ex probably still hasn't forgiven me for that. For that
moment, dog, you should send that to her as like a Christmas card. Find it and put yourself in there and send it to her. Be like, I'm so sorry. Oh my god. All right, so you're in England. You have your family. You're kind of loosely affiliated with the church. So the way that I met you was I've never met you before. Small world, but we never crossed paths. I think we were in the same place a couple of times, like maybe PLA or something. But I
vaguely remember you from PLA. Like I kind of remember you were there. But that's it. I just kind of like, maybe we're on the same bus, you're on a different bus, but I just kind of like remember you. Like I remember your name and I remember like your persona from there, but I don't remember anything else. We basically didn't know each other beyond, you know, being in the same group of 300 kids, like just going around the country on a bus.
Yeah. It's wild. Sometimes I'll see pictures from PLA and it's just like, I'll look for myself and I'm like, it's like 50 kids in the picture and I'm none of them. Yeah. And I'm like, oh yeah, there was fucking hundreds of us. Like I'm not going to be in every picture.
Exactly. So yeah, I know we were there, but, and I just kind of like remember you there, but like that was in 97, right? Yeah. And now it's 20. I hit you up in 2020. So that's 23 years later.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, we hadn't like spoken since then basically. Yeah.
So kind of, it was almost out of nowhere, I think, as I recall.
Yeah.
You messaged me and you were like, hey, I'm starting this podcast and I want people that were in the Unification Church to tell their story.
Yeah.
And you were like, I'm looking for all different kinds of people. Kind of, you know, with unique situations that can highlight different aspects of the church.
Yeah.
And what you created was called the Falling Out Podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So what I want to know firstly is, why did you decide to do this project? I mean, it sounds like from what I can understand, you and your girl were kind of out living your own life, doing your own thing.
Yeah.
Kind of away from the church. And then all of a sudden, where did this idea or inspiration come from?
So it's a great question. Thank you for asking. I guess let me take a, so my ex and I were together up until about 3 years ago. Well, I guess like 3.5 years ago now. And even though we were both kind of like out, right? Like we didn't really have anything to do with the UC, but and we also had a kid a little over 7 years ago, 7 years ago now. And having a kid is difficult in any circumstance. We had a few kind of health issues along the way that I think made it even more difficult and really kind of like highlighted some of the fractures in our relationship. And it kind of became apparent that there were a lot of flaws in our relationship and a lot of things that we could sort of patch up. We almost like, we had the bandwidth to patch them up when we didn't have a kid, but when we had a kid, it made it really hard for us to patch over these, what were actually some pretty like fundamental just differences in us and like how we like relate and connect as human beings. And so in the wake of like having a kid again, a few difficulties along the way, we decided to split up. And I think that's not an easy thing to do for anyone, but fortunately now, I mean, it's been a few years. It's very difficult when you go through it, but now, you know, like 3.5 years later, I can say like, I think we're actually both in a better place. And we're much more free to be ourselves. The reason I mention that is like when we were together, we could never like really look at the flaws in our relationship dispassionately. We could never look at them, you know, objectively, because we felt like we had to make it work. We had to stick it together because of the way that we were put together. And then all of a sudden when we removed that, it was like, I could look at that relationship and I could understand a lot of the flaws in it. And these are not flaws in her at all. And I want to make it clear, I have a ton of love and respect for her still. And she's still my best friend to this day. But there's still, there were a lot of flaws in how we related, because when your relationship starts from the foundation of like, you just have to make this work without making space for your needs or without feeling like your needs matter or you can even want to like demand certain things out of the relationship, like you just end up squashing a lot of parts of yourself. And so I think we both felt that basically. And so when we could remove ourselves from that paradigm, we actually realized like there were a lot of things that just weren't right about the relationship. And we could also look back finally. This is why I feel like I kind of left the church twice. I left once when I was 18, mm-hmm. but I left again when I was like 36, when my relationship ended. And for the first time I could actually like look at my relationship and look at my life and like not feel like I had to keep something together based on the pretenses of the church, basically. So when that relationship ended, all of a sudden I could look back and I could look at the relationship and be like, I was like, holy shit, that was fucked up. that was really fucked up to put two people together at such a young age, and just force them to make it work no matter what. That was like, there's something wrong with that. Like that's not right. And you know, I like my ex-wife is younger than me significantly. So she was forced to grow up quick. I was forced to grow up quick too, but you know, I'm older than her. So at least I had a few more years before getting there, but
yeah,
there's a lot wrong with that. And I don't think you should force people into that. And like, you know, people shouldn't get married because their parents just say like, you know, you have to marry someone else based on this made up religion, basically. I just, there's a lot wrong with that. And I think like having a kid, I could look at it and be like, would I ever want any of this for my own kid? Hell no. No, I would never ask my kid to do any of this. So sorry, I feel like I'm kind of digressing here, but that's kind of the backstory. That's kind of like where I was from 2015. But then like 3 years ago, that happened. I felt like for the first time I could actually look back and be like, what the fuck happened? Like why did I do that? What was happening in my life? And I guess a few things happened, and I am gonna answer your question, but I wanna set the backstory. So I started just kind of thinking, I guess at that point, that's when I realized like this cult like had a really like sizable impact on me in my life. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking about that, and I started reading books about cults and how they operate. And one of the books I read, was by or is by a woman named Janja Lalich. She's written a few books, but one of her books is called Take Back Your Life. And it's written specifically for people that join cults and then later leave. And it's about how to like understand what you've been through and then rebuild your life afterwards. But one of the points that she makes in that book, which no one had ever mentioned to me, was if you come from a cult that exhibits a high degree of control over sexuality, that is the same thing as experiencing sexual abuse.
Wow.
And reading that, like, honestly hit me like a fucking sledgehammer.
Wow.
Because I was like, oh my God, that's what happened to me. Like I was sexually abused. And all of us were. All of us that grew up in that environment were sexually abused. And I never, up until that moment when I was, you know, 36, 37 reading that book, I forget exactly what month it was when I read it, but I was like, holy shit. Like now I have words to describe like what happened to me and what happened to so many of us. And it's not something that have ever occurred to me, but sometimes that's what you need is just someone to just like give you the language to express what happened to you. I read that book, and I guess something else that happened like around that time, sorry, this is a very long story, but it's something that I feel like is worth mentioning, is like I remember watching. Have you read His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman, or have you seen the TV shows?
No, I haven't seen it.
Okay, so I guess I read the books a long time ago, maybe probably like over 15 years ago. But I watched there, there's a television version of it. It's on the BBC. It's probably in the US as well. Yeah. This is in the last couple of years that it came out. Like season one came out like less than 2 years ago, I think. You know, that book uses the device that the book and the television series that's based on. They have this device where kids grow up and they have what they call demons associated with them. And demons are these animals that keep close to the kids. And the development of the kid and the animal are intertwined. And when the kids hit puberty, the animals, but basically before then they can change form. But once the kids hit puberty, animal, like its form solidifies. And that's part of like, of the kid growing up basically is them doing that. And the, basically the, more or less the demon is effectively like an allegory for the kids and their sexuality that they start to experience when they hit puberty. And it's sort of a device for exploring the relationship between those things as the kids grow up. So that's kind of like the device of the book. But in the book and in the TV series there's this organization called the Magisterium, which is it's like a church basically. It's a church, and the church is going through all kinds of efforts to try to figure out a way to cut the kids from their demons, to cut them off from their sexuality, because they view it as such a threat to life that they have to cut it and can control that device about them. And there's a moment in the first, there's a couple moments in the first season where, and I was watching this maybe like 2 years ago, when it came out over here. I would say two moments. So, one is when there's a kid who, his demon is cut from him. And the way that his demon is cut from him and, he basically becomes a zombie. And his mother goes and grabs him and holds him and is like, like the kid is not the same anymore. He's a shell of what he used to be. And like she's so angry for the Magisterium for cutting off the demon from the kid. And it break the mother is horrified by what's happened. And when I think about what happened to us, our parents were pushing us to have our demons cut. Our parents wanted us to have our demons cut. They were pushing us into the Magisterium so that the Magisterium could cut us. And in this book, the mother is rightly horrified by what's happened to her kid. But in our cases, our parents were pushing us into that machine to have our demons cut from us. And like honestly, when I saw, I was sobbing when I saw that. This like, you know, kids like teenage tween TV show. I was like sobbing when I saw that. And because I realized that that's what happened to us basically. But our parents were pushing us into that situation. And then I think it was in the next episode, the main character Lyra, she is about to have her demon cut from her in this machine that cuts them. And her mother is the one who's architected all this technology and this whole movement to cut the kids from their demons. And she's actually the one who kind of like made it possible for the first kid to be cut, disconnected from his demon. But when her own kid is in the machine, she can't let it happen to her, and she stops it from happening. And this is like the villain in the whole fucking series of three books. And I just thought about that dynamic of like this villain, like this mother, this villainous mother sees her kid about to have this like this horrific damage done to her, and even she cannot let it happen to her own daughter. And yet all of us suffered that damage from our parents. And I was sobbing again when I watched that on television. And so I guess something about those moments really, really hit me about seeing that and just realizing like our parents were very flawed in what they were doing. I also had another experience where I remember telling someone, like a couple who grew up in the church, I remember telling them like how I felt like we had suffered abuse from our parents. That was it. I was like, look, I read this book. It fucking changed my perception on everything. I think we suffered sexual abuse as kids as a result of everything that we've been through. And I was at this couple's house, and the wife, honestly, I could say the best way to describe what happened was she like almost like suffered a psychotic break in that moment. Just when I mentioned the thought that we had gone through that, she was like running around the house screaming. Wow. And like there had been we had been drinking a lot at this moment. And but I remember looking at my friends. So I was there with two other friends, who like one of whom grew up in the church and his girlfriend. I look at them and I was pretty wasted at this point, but I look at them and I'm like, this is like fucking From Dusk Till Dawn. We need to get the fuck out of here. Because she like her whole mentality had changed. It was like, she was a very like normal person. And then something with like confronting her with this truth just like fucking shifted her mentality completely. And she like just became a different person basically. So I guess, I don't know. I guess those are just kind of illustrations of some of the hard truths, some of the hard realizations that I feel like I've come through in the last like few years. And then I guess bringing it back to like your overarching question. The other thing is like, if I think about my family, so my parents are still in the movement to varying degrees. One of my siblings is deep into QAnon. And so, you know, just think about that for a second. So, okay, like your whole life, like I went through a marriage with someone that was like very strange and like not something that I would want to wish upon my own child. My parents are still involved with this cult to some degree. One of my siblings is involved in another cult to some degree. Mm-hmm. It's not an exaggeration to say that cults have had like are the single most defining feature of my life. No question asked. 100%, like there's nothing else that has had more impact upon my life than cults, effectively. Mm-hmm. And I see this sort of like this further like spiral into Q and Trump and stuff like that. See one of my siblings getting pulled into that. And I just remember thinking like, I don't know, there are some core truths that people like you and I have witnessed that maybe we can use to shed light on this situation. And for me, the final penny drop moment was when I was I actually attended a group call on this Facebook group that you and I are a part of, where people were just like talking about their experiences like growing up in the UC and leaving. And I remember there was a short group chat where, I mean, there were like maybe 20 people on that call, but they split up into subgroups, and the group I was on had maybe 4 or 5 people, and everyone was given like 2 minutes to talk. But even in those 2 minutes, like everyone had such different stories for leaving. And for me, that really like illustrated just how different all those experiences were. And because I always thought like I had my own experience for leaving, and like that's what it was like, and it was the same for everyone. But and just in those short, you know, few minutes of conversation, I realized that everyone else had very unique and different experiences, and there's no way to share those experiences. There was no way for, you know, for me to learn from the people who had gone through that. And I think back to, you know, like the, you know, that the analogy of the kids in His Dark Materials, like just suffering this abuse at the hands of their parents. Like you know, how valuable would it be if you could like help them to see what was happening? Because the thing is, I didn't know what was happening to me when it was happening to me. Mm-hmm. I don't think my parents knew what was happening. I think they were misled severely. But you know, imagine what you could do if you could just like help people understand what was happening to them. And I don't think, like, you know, my story I'm sure has some value on its own, but I think there's more value in like creating a forum for other people to collect those stories. And I just felt like there wasn't a way to share that. And I also felt like, you know, you can go and Google the Unification Church and you can read about all this stuff and, you know, this ceremony and that and the history and the theology and all that stuff. But none of that is really getting to the root of the human experience that's happening to those people. And I felt like there was no light that was really being shined upon those experiences. And I wanted to create a place where light could be shared, could be shed upon those experiences. And maybe, just maybe, people will listen and it might help them understand what they were going through and maybe be able to change something in their life. Mm-hmm. And that's why I started doing what I'm doing. Sorry, it's a very long explanation, but
no, that's what's up, man.
I think
the way that you explained it is right on. Like, the majority of people I know, when we started leaving the church, there was no, our generation, the generation before us would just go to STF or get blessed and then just disappear. And we had no idea where they went, whether they left, whether, you know, we had no idea. So it was like a cycle of you grow up, you're told what to do by your leaders. You go through all your schooling, your leaders disappear, you graduate, you go to STF and then you disappear. Yeah. So the majority of our therapy, I think has been when we start going out and drinking as friends, as ex-Moonies hanging out together,
yeah,
and we're
exactly.
smoking weed or we're drinking and we're talking and we're like, hey, do you remember this? Yeah, that was fucked up. Oh, this is how I actually felt when that happened. Because, you know, as a group, you never want to be the one to be negative. We were taught very specifically, you don't multiply sin, you don't multiply evil. So everyone just kept their own shit to themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Now that we're adults.
That's part of the group. And actually, I don't want to interrupt, but thing I also want to say is that I also took a course run by a woman named Alex Stein, who's one of one of the academic leaders in like studying cults. And I took a course run by her in London, where she talks about like the layers of control that cults employ. And I think this is whether you're in a cult or not. I think it's really valuable just to understand the types of control that they apply. And for me, I feel like that was really eye-opening just to understand. I always kind of knew there were all these like these ties that bind, these common tactics that cult use. But if you take a course run by an academic who studied them, then all of a sudden like they have words for it. They can name it and they can pinpoint it. And so again, I feel like that kind of fed into my thought process about this, about like I felt like there was no way and actually what specifically is most of them will create that cut, that break in information. When people leave, they're gone. Yeah. That's very common. That's a common tactic. And so for us, like that is completely evident, right? People leave and they're gone and you miss that tie is just gone. And I look at some of the resources like, you know, How Well Do You Know Your Moon is an amazing resource of all this kind of like inside, like information about like what's happening in the church here and there. But I feel like that forum doesn't allow for the same sort of nuance that can happen in the recorded word, in the conversation. And so it just felt like there was a need to offer that. Because again, like, you know, cults do that. That's what they do. They cut off that tie, and it's intentional because they don't want that information being passed along. So this is how we cut the tie. It's by having a conversation.
And I've definitely felt, you know, since I was on your episode, I shared my story, and I've had so many people reach out to me. You know, I've always known a lot of people in the church. I've been like a pretty public guy. Like I'd be the guy on stage, you know, singing. Or, I didn't give lectures, but I would give like testimonies and stuff. So I've known a lot of people in the church, been connected to a lot of people in the church. but it's been interesting since I first went on your podcast, because I've been getting a lot of like love and hate, right? I've been getting a lot of people coming to me saying, like, I heard your story. I had no idea. I'm so sorry. And then sharing their own stories with me. Yeah. And then I've also had people, like, especially older church people, that are like so angry and offended, like, you know.
Oh, dude, tell me about the offensive ones, because I haven't gotten any hate mail yet.
Yeah.
I've only gotten the love. It's amazing. So I know the hate's coming.
The thing is, they know me, right? And I'm the guy that's like still on Facebook talking to first gen, like, oh, you follow Trump? Let's talk about it. Tell me why, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. My approach is like, I'm about compassion and love. You and Ren are like a little more like fiery and angry.
Yeah.
But you know, everyone's kind of in.
It's all right. Everyone's got their. Yeah. 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 Exactly.
So, so what's interesting is these people, you know, like these first gens, they don't want to admit that purity culture hurts people. They don't want to admit that the church hurts people. So they'll reach out to me and be like, why are you guys doing this? You know, why are you talking about the past? Why are you bringing up this old stuff? Just move on. Mm-hmm. And it had me, I sat with that for a little bit, and here's my response, right? Yeah. So the way that we were raised was to live for the sake of others. We were taught to put everything before us, as far as like other people were concerned. So when I think of all these people sharing their stories, whether it's me or people on our Facebook group or people coming on the podcasts or whatever, we're literally doing the thing that our parents and this church taught us to do.
Mm.
We're not sharing these stories about purity culture and how the church affected us for us. We're sharing it for the people that are still on STF that we're scared might get raped or murdered. We're doing it for the people that are growing up in a puritanical church that are, you know, maybe LGBTQ or just a regular heterosexual person that feel like they're being repressed or they're not good enough or unloved, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So we're in my heart, this is how I feel. I can't speak for everyone, but I feel like all this anger and all of this, like this final, like sharing of people's stories, like we're doing this literally for each other, for
the next
generation of church kid that we don't want to feel the way that we felt.
Yeah.
And I think that, it's interesting because this Facebook group we're both in, it's been around for a long time, but because of COVID, I really feel like there's been like this shift.
It's gone bananas. It's gone bananas.
So many people have just like, we've been able to hold in all these emotions our whole lives and suppress and suppress and suppress.
Yeah.
But because of COVID, that shit is just overflowing and like, and looking for a way out. So, you know,
and people are listening. I guess
just
to tap into that, like I agree completely. And that Facebook group is monumental in its impact, but I guess just kind of going into my thought process with the podcast, it's like I just going back to it. And actually, I think early in my career, so I work in sales, B2B sales, basically. And I had a really good boss early in my career. And he basically said, like, if you're ever talking to someone about anything important, you either do it in person or you do it on the phone. In writing is always for afterwards, just to confirm stuff. And I think there's a grain of truth to there's still a grain of truth to that now. And I feel like I just feel like you can get so much more emotion and so much more, there's so much more nuance in how you say things, whether it's, you know, in person or voice, like you can make things 10 times more impactful if you can do it that way. And I just, again, that's why I wanted to do it in podcast form, because it just felt like a way to kind of like bring even more like emotion and clarity and like feeling to the whole endeavor of trying to talk about these things. So this is not to take away from the place of that Facebook group or anywhere else where things happen in writing. It just felt like talking about things and having the conversation, it just opens up a bigger, like, you know, realm of experience, basically. So that's why I wanted to do it in that format.
I mean, I feel like there's so many different ways people are expressing themselves, whether it's podcasting like me and you, or art or writing, or there's so many different ways people are speaking out now. And the thing that I wanted to say is, like, a lot of people feel like it's a us versus them kind of situation that's happening right now with people speaking out. And my authentic feeling is, hey, people are sharing their trauma. They're sharing their pain. They're sharing their experience. We should all open our hearts to each other and listen. because maybe you grew up in the purity culture and maybe waiting till marriage worked for you. That's great. But the other side of that is somebody who grew up in purity culture and had to repress who they were every second of their day because they thought that the ever-loving God wouldn't love them, that their parents wouldn't love them, you know, and they thought that if they ever shared who they really were, it's better to kill yourself than be that person.
Yeah.
So there's two sides of every story. So what I want to say to people that are just upset that there's negativity out there, when we're talking about the Unification Church and the history of it and bringing to light things that aren't good, if you're affected negatively by that, man, you got to look at yourself because that isn't a reflection of you as a person. And even if you're a first gen that gave your whole life to the church, unless you're complicit in doing things and you knew that you were doing bad things.
Yeah.
You also, you don't have to carry all that water for the church and for the Moon family.
Yeah.
You are who you are. And that's the freedom right now that's coming from so many people sharing their stories. And my authentic hope that is by people listening to your podcast, just open your heart and minds and listen to what these people are saying.
Yeah.
And let's have honest dialogue. You know what I mean? There's, you tell me if I'm wrong, and I know that you're righteously angry because even on my episode, you know, you do like your intro and outro after the episodes.
Yeah.
And like me and you talked and you were like, it was like very like flat. Right. And then I listened to my intro and you were like, yo, fuck Reverend Moon. This son of
a, I was fucking angry, dude.
I was like, yo, Elgin's fiery. We had this conversation that he wasn't this mad.
Yeah. No. I keep it chill for the interview, but then, but then when I'm in my own head recording the intro or the outro, it can, I might've gone a bit overboard there, but it was real and it was me. And I think, I stand by everything I said.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. Well, the reason I said that is I just want to make this point before we move on.
Yeah.
People like me and you, you know, you gave 18 years of your life to the church. You did it their way for 18 years.
Yeah.
I did it their way for like 26 years.
Yeah.
So we're doing something different now. And a lot of people want to say to me, you know, why don't you have both sides of a conversation on your podcast? You know, this person is sharing all these negative experiences.
Yeah.
Why don't you have someone on the other side of the church
that
can share the positives of what they experienced?
Yeah.
And I just want to say, we did that shit. I did it for 26 years. You did it for 18 years. Yeah. People did that for, we followed that side for years of our life and it hurt a lot of people. And those people are just being unburdened now, but being able to share it. So
I think
in a lot of ways you started that in the public realm by interviewing us. And I guess what I want to know is to you, what's the end game here? Like, what is your, you know, why are you doing this still?
I don't know. It's a great question. And I mean, I have to say when I, the simple answer is I don't know. And I think, I don't know if you remember, but when I first contacted you just about interviewing, I was like, I don't know what I'm doing here. I was like, and that's what I told everyone. I was like, there's one thing you need to know about me. I've never done this. I don't know what it's going to look like. I don't know when it's going to come out. I don't know how this shit's going to work. But I'm going to do something here. So if you're willing to work with me on that basis, then let's do this. And I give you credit because you trusted me and I had no idea what would happen. Right. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the end game, I mean, so I mentioned this on my show, but like, you know, within a week of publishing, one of my best friends called me up and said that his mother had listened to the podcast and was leaving the church after being a member for nearly 50 years, 40, 50 years. I don't know. I don't know the exact number. So that was
the first episode after Donna's episode.
Well, actually I dropped like 6 episodes on the first day. I don't know.
Oh,
Yeah. So I dropped the first tranche of episodes on the 25th of January, which is my 40th birthday. By the way, I want to go on the record and saying I came out on that day to give you motherfuckers a providential, you know, kick in the ass, motherfuckers.
Hit them with the 40, baby.
Yeah. So that's why I dropped on that day. But less than a week later, I got a call from so I don't know which episode it was. There were 6 episodes. It was 2 for you, 2 for Donna, and 2 for Teddy. Mm-hmm. But Yeah, one of my best friends called me and said, look, you know, my mother's been kind of like considering leaving for a long time. But after listening to your podcast, she's finally said, yeah, I'm done. And I was honestly like, I was in tears when that happened, because I didn't know that was going to happen. I wasn't mm-hmm. expecting it to happen. I wasn't really expecting anything to happen. Quite honestly, I just, like I said, I didn't know. I've never done this before. I didn't have any specific expectations. I just felt like these stories needed to be told, and I just wanted to put them into the world and see what happened. And so, to achieve that sort of, I called you probably remember this. So this would have been 6 days after publication of those first episodes. So I called my first set of interviewees in order. So I called Donna first, and I talked to her and I told her what happened. And she said that someone had actually contacted her after listening to her episode, and they had left as well. They after hearing what happened to her, they were like, I'm done. And so they had left. And then I called you. I was actually kind of in shock when I called you. I don't know if you remember that, but I was kind of in shock when I called you. And I called Teddy as well. I just wanted to call everyone that was part of that first tranche. And I was just, I mean, and I'm still just kind of like humbled by being able to do that. And like, that's honestly probably, I don't know what else I'm going to achieve in my life, but just to do that, to give those people, like whoever they are, like X number of years back in their life.
Yeah.
I'm fucking proud of that, dude.
It's
like prouder than anything else I've done, dude.
Yeah.
And prouder than anything I probably ever will do. Like, so I don't know. I mean, I was really humbled by that. And it just makes me want to keep going. So that happened within the first week. And honestly, I had no expectation of that happening at all. And then, you know, a lot of other people, more people than I can count, have contacted me and just said like, hey, I grew up in the church. Like it's been amazing for me to hear like just what other people have gone through. It just makes me feel like actually, yeah, this was a thing that I went through. And just thank you so much for doing this. You know, every week people are contacting me basically. I haven't heard so much of like people leaving directly, but I hope it's still happening. Mm-hmm. So look, I mean, what's the end game? I don't know, but I just want to keep doing that. I just want to keep giving people that experience. And I'd like to, in terms of where I'd like to go with the format, I mean, I've always wanted to sort of move beyond just the Moonies, to explore the experience of people who grew up in other places. I am, in a way, I think actually kind of like having the tie back to the Moonies, it kind of like, I feel like I can have a much more detailed conversation with you than I could have with someone else.
Sure. We have a short laugh.
Yeah. And I can laugh about shit that with you that I couldn't laugh about with other people.
Yeah.
And that happens on every episode. But my hope is that, you know, this could be valuable to people from other faiths as well. And people have contacted me who didn't grow up in this movement, but who said like a lot of these stories they're telling are really, really interesting and really impactful. And I guess my hope for where it goes is to start like broadening the net and incorporating those stories from other places. I'd also like to, I guess, get a bit more like structured. I don't know if that makes sense, but like think about, you know, including academics or like people who can talk to the audience of like, hey, like I'm an expert in cults and cult recovery. Like I to be clear, I am not 100%.
But
yeah, like,
we're just two like, dudes. We're like, not experts. We're just of
like, yeah. But like, what if I could get an expert to be like, hey, like for your audience, this is what they should look out for.
Yeah.
These are the things that they should be thinking about. These are how they should approach X, Y, and Z. Like that to me, I think that would be interesting. And I think, so I've got some ideas about trying to kind of broaden it. And that could be, you know, that's not like Moonie specific. That could be applicable to other, you know, people from other sects as well. I also want to, I got some other ideas. So as we're talking now, I'm going to be wrapping up season one of Falling Out, which is crazy because I didn't even know. Honestly, I had no idea. Like I said, I had no idea what the fuck I was doing. But I guess after this first like tranche of interviews, it kind of became clear that like there's a natural ending point in the next episode. And I need to take a break and like kind of revamp a lot of the stuff and just kind of like make it better. I feel like season one was a prototype. It was like I was just trying to figure out what I was doing, and now I kind of know how things work, and I know how to make things better, and I got some ideas, and I'm planning. So season two is going to go places that I think people that are going to be unexpected to people, and I'm even now talking about season three as well.
Damn,
so I've got like I've like it's good, but in terms of the end goal. Again, I don't know. Like, I just want to give a place for these stories because no one's telling them, and I just feel like, there are a lot of other like cult podcasts and stuff, but a lot of them don't have the layer of familiarity that this one does for this audience. And I don't want to limit myself just to like, you know, I would love for my audience to grow beyond just ex-Moonies, but you know, also like the fact that we have that familiarity can lead to just some really deep conversations that I couldn't have with other people, I think.
Yeah. I think just having, I mean, our audiences are probably very similar, a lot of extra people. But I've seen so many people that have listened to these interviews and they're sharing their stories, and that's gratifying enough, man. I mean, it's so heartbreaking and humbling and also beautiful that like people I don't even know on Instagram are friending me and sending me messages like, hey, I heard your interview with so-and-so, and I just want to tell you a little bit about what I went through. Like,
you
can't put a price tag on that. Like,
I know you can't, you can't. And like, I mean, I got a message on Instagram, like within the last few days, like someone who's like going through a, you know, pretty unique situation in their church. Like they're basically like an offering child, which is, you know, a kid who was like given away. And they were kind of like looking for advice on like maybe, and I think they had another sibling who was also an offering child given away to a different family. And they were looking for advice about how to like rekindle that relationship. And I was like, damn, like, well, that wasn't my experience, but like, you know, maybe I can help you find other people or like find some resources for you that could help you in that, you know, in that situation. And even that's a really gratifying and humbling thing for me to be like, look, I could, you know, materially impact this person's life. Even if it's not, you know, all I do is like connect them with a resource or a person or something like that. If I can act in that manner, then great. Again, kind of going back to what we were saying before, like how much value can you add to someone's life by, you know, giving them that time back or helping them improve that relationship or, you know, something like that. That's extraordinarily gratifying.
No doubt.
It's an amazing thing to be a part of. So I'm hoping it continues.
Yeah. Well, I hope everybody looks out for season two of Falling Out. If you haven't listened to it yet, the best episode is by me, you know, check out my
obviously.
No, I'm just playing. Episodes listen to them all. They're all good.
Episodes 3 and 4, but actually just on that, what's, I'm just kind of curious, like what have been kind of like the most impactful things that you've like listened to or like, you know, what's been kind of like the most interesting thing that you've heard on the show?
I'll tell you something that's interesting to me. Well, not interesting, but that has been really eye-opening to me is hearing people share their stories, especially women, the way that they were treated by church adults, the way that they were treated by their own families. You know, I always had like a surface knowledge of how the church was sexist and how it treated women.
Yeah.
But to hear like these just real in-depth stories, you know, like listening to Donna's story, and I don't know Donna from Adam. I've never met her. But hear the double standard of how, you know, she had a relationship with the boy and the way that the church punished each of them completely separately. To me was so eye-opening to just be like, you know, I don't know what I don't know. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And so many times that I've heard people's stories and I'm just like, you know, I feel complicit. Like I've made it a point even to apologize to people for my roles. if anything I ever said or did as a church elder hurt them, you know, whether it's purity culture or divine principle, whatever, in any yeah. way, as far as the church is concerned, you know, my intention, I think, much like most of our parents, was never to hurt anyone. We were doing what we were taught and what we were conditioned to believe is the yeah. most helpful and right thing for people. So to me, it's been moving, not only hearing those, but like I said, being on our Facebook group and having people share, or people reach out on Instagram to be like, you know, this happened to me, or this made me feel yeah. this way, or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, to me, that just, it just blows me away to know that I was a part of this thing for so long in my life. And like, even though I always try to be there for people and be compassionate and love people and support people, there's just so much more that I was completely unaware of. How so many people were suffering. And if I knew that, man, I think it would have just been a very different experience for me. You know, it literally only took my brother coming out for me to say, fuck the church. So I can't imagine when I was young, I heard some of these people's experiences. I mean, I would have just left so much younger because I have this righteous anger, you know, for them.
Yeah.
So it's, been,
I think
it's
that, profound. I guess that's part of, I think that's kind of like, that's one of, one of the things I'm trying to do is just like, if I think of like, you know, I told you about my friend whose mother left after, you know, 40, 50 years, like, I mean, as a parent, I can say it's probably quite difficult, like looking at your own life and trying to recognize the flaws there or the ways that you might've hurt people. That's a really tough thing to do. But if you can shift the perspective and just like listen to the story of someone else, like, you know, think of my friend's mother, like listening to Donna's story or your story, like she doesn't know you. She doesn't know your family, like, or the families of the other folks. And all of a sudden she can hear these stories about like all this horrific shit that people have been through. And she has no responsibility for that. Right.
Yeah.
She has no part in that. So she doesn't have skin in the game. So all of a sudden she can look at it in a way that she couldn't look at when she's looking at her own family. And then maybe like that perspective shift of taking the skin out of the game can help someone to be like, oh my God, this whole thing is fucking disastrous. I'm going to get the fuck out. And that's what happened in that instance. And that's what kind of hoping to keep doing with the perspective shift. And that's why I say like, actually interviewing people from other cults, I think could be quite interesting as well to give you a different perspective. And I think, and actually kind of circling back on some of the other stuff that I've been talking about, like when I took that course run by Alex Stein on cults, I met a bunch of other people who had all joined and left cults on their own. So none of them were second generation cult members, except for me. But one of like the common themes that they mentioned was like what got them out of their cult was like watching a documentary or reading a story about like another cult and how it operated and then seeing the similarities. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh my God, am I in a cult?
Yeah,
and then they think about it and it's that perspective shift. All of a sudden, boom, you snap. And then you're like, oh shit, that's what's happening to me.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that these stories can help to be part of that perspective shift for people, basically.
I feel the same way. And I know that it's very hard. Like we were all conditioned in a way that we internalized, like we didn't have a master controlling us as far as the church is concerned. We were conditioned in a way that we were our own master. We were our own big brother watching us. So we like feel like, I mean, maybe not the royal we, because not me anymore, but when I was in the church, any attack on the church was an attack on me, whether or not I had anything to do with it.
Yeah.
Whatever the moons would do, if they were building a fifth palace in Korea and somebody was like, blah, 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 I'd be like, yo, fuck you. This is why we're doing it. You don't understand. So just getting away from that is hard enough. But my sincere desire is just, I just want us to listen to each other and just, you know, if you really want to die having no relationship with your kids, but thinking you made Reverend Moon really happy, that's your choice. But to me, it's fucking tragic.
Yeah.
Maybe you and your parents don't have a good relationship. And now you and your kids don't have a good relationship. And when Moon was on his deathbed, was he thinking about your kids and your family, or what was he, you know what I mean? So my sincere hope is that this brings like some kind of like healing to yeah. the relationships of people in and out of the church, and just creates dialogue. Like, I don't give a fuck about burning it all down. I don't care about any of the moons personally. They can all go fuck themselves. I don't care yeah. about them, but I do sincerely care about the first and second gen members of the people in the church that affected me in a loving way.
Yeah. You
know, there were so many people that loved me and were good to me. There were people that were shitty, but there were also people that were good. So that's, I think, in my head, these conversations are for that. So when people are like, why are you being negative? Why are you trying to rip it down? Man, I ain't trying to rip shit down. I'm trying to fix shit. You know what I mean? I'm trying to create, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know, whatever. Maybe I'm just
talking. I think, I guess I agree. Like, my hope is that this can serve as, you know, something to help rebuild relationships for people in their families. Mm-hmm. But I also hope it burns that motherfucking shit to the ground. Because those fucking assholes deserve to burn, motherfucker. I have a deep, I don't want to use the word hatred because I feel like that's a bit too extreme, but they're evil.
Yeah.
They are evil in my view. I mean, you know, you look at L. Ron Hubbard, look at Keith Raniere, look at Jim Jones, like look at David Koresh. Mm-hmm. They're the same. Moon is the same as those people. And that's one of the points I'm trying to make. Like, you know, if maybe you don't think those people are evil, okay, fine. But if you think any of them are evil, then you should also think that Moon is evil and his whole family is evil.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of other evil cult leaders out there.
Yeah, man.
That's, I guess I'm, yeah. I don't know. I just feel like that's my personal opinion. Mm-hmm. And if this can help in burning that shit to the ground, then great. But I'm more interested, I'm more interested in helping people rebuild what they've got with their friends and their family than in burning shit to the ground. But also, here's the thing. If 10 people left the church tomorrow, or if 100 people or 1,000 people left the church tomorrow, like, guess I don't know what the number is, but eventually the whole thing just implodes upon itself without anything burning to the ground. You know what? All it is people walking away.
Yeah,
they just they don't even have to. And I mentioned this on my last episode. You don't even have to say anything. Just fade out. Just stop going to the meetings. Stop taking the calls. Stop talking to the people. If they're your friends and you want to talk to them, then great. Talk to them about fucking Netflix and, you know, sports or whatever. But like, you know, if you want to have a relationship, then have a relationship with them on like stuff that's real, but not some made up theology for this, you know, lunatic dead man. I don't want to burn this relationship to the ground just because it was based on this flawed religion in the past, right? I'm not advocating that people burn their relationships to the ground. What I'm saying is, like, just walk away from the structure, walk away from the organization.
Exactly how I feel. Cut the ends out. They don't need to be a part of your life.
Yeah, exactly. Stop going to the meeting, stop giving them your money. Stop spending time on them and invest it in the relationships with people you care about. And that's all that I'm trying to instigate here. But here's the thing. If enough people do that, then the whole thing's a house of cards that crumbles, right? That crumbles, right? Without burning anything to the ground, the whole thing crumbles because the money stops and the whole thing just falters there. So that would be a great result if that happened, you know? I would be completely happy with that.
Word up. All right, my friend, it is about the end of the podcast. Okay. We got to do the lightning round real quick. I got two questions I got to ask you.
Okay, you didn't prepare me for this. Okay.
Nobody gets prepared for the lightning round, my G.
Let me top up my wine here. Okay.
All right. It's only two questions. It ain't too wild.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
The first one would be, if you had the Harry Potter invisibility blanket, and you could go anywhere in the Unification Church, where would you go with the invisibility blanket?
That is a great question. So I remember hearing, so when I went to Chungpyeong a long time ago, I remember hearing that Daemonim, she was like so spiritually like open or something like that, that like she would take ice baths, or like ice baths were like part of her daily ritual or something like that to like keep her like spiritually at the same at the right level for doing her mediumship or something like that. I think that's what it was. It was like she's so like spiritually pure that like she needs to do ice baths like every day for, I don't know, whatever, 3 hours or whatever the number was to keep her at that level. So I would like to go to wherever her supposed ice bath was and just like take a photo of her, you know, just like, I don't know, chilling in a bathrobe, drinking a cup of tea when she's meant to be having an ice bath, or just something, you know, just like something that just completely,
you want some gotcha exposes. Journalism.
Yeah. I want a gotcha just cause I'm sorry. She's not who she says she is. And that would be very easy to debunk if you could just go there.
That would be mad wild to have like behind the scenes photos of like Reverend Moon was up all night praying, and then you see the photo and he's like playing Game Boy, fucking eating a hamburger.
I know. Yeah. Well, this is the thing. This like, yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. Or like, this is what I'm getting at is like you say, kind of going behind the curtain, right? Like, mm-hmm. what is happening with this, with like, yeah, these times when they say, yeah, exactly. He was fasting and praying and having like the spiritual, like, no, he wasn't. He was probably like, he was just like watching TV. I almost imagine him kind of like Trump, just like watching Fox News all day and like having people bringing him cheeseburgers or something like that. I don't know what, but what's happening, at least with Trump, like you would read news reports, you kind of knew what was happening behind the curtain in a way, but with Moon, you had no idea. But what was happening to him in his cheeseburger moments, basically.
All right. So you're watching an old lady in an ice bath. Gotcha. Pervert.
Yeah. Next question. Exactly. Exactly.
So here's the big one. If you could interview Reverend Moon, mm-hmm. and you only had one question to ask him, mm-hmm. what question would you ask him? He's got to tell the truth.
Easy. Do you actually believe your own bullshit? That's the question. Because that underpins everything. Do you actually believe everything about the theology that you say? And this is something actually, like going back to my classes with Alex Stein, like one of the questions I asked her, I was like, is there any academic research into whether or not cult leaders actually believe their own bullshit? And she basically said, like, it's a really hard thing to measure. It's very difficult to get a real read on that. So unfortunately, there is no great academic research on that subject, but that's what I would like to know. Like, I guess in a way, like you could almost forgive him if he actually believed everything, like Jesus came to him and he but if he didn't, then that would be like just ironclad proof that he was a con man from the beginning.
I feel like it's so hard to nail that down because the thing about church theology is they like to change that shit whenever it excuses something. You know, like, for example, when I found out Moon had kids out of wedlock, that's about the biggest no-no that you could have, according to him.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I got the answer, well, you know, so-and-so in the Bible. And until you go to spirit world, you'll never truly understand the reasoning. You know, like you get these woo-woo answers when somebody breaks the rules in the cult, especially the person at the highest level, you know?
Yeah. So
that's why even like, trying to ask, do you believe this? They could honestly believe they do and not, like, it's just so removed from human beings.
I agree. I guess my the one underpinning assumption in that question, like if you could ask him one question, will be like he would have to tell the truth.
That's true.
Like he would have to tell the truth because you could weasel your way out of that question in so many different ways. But if I could ask him one question and I knew I was going to get the honest answer, then I think that's what it would be. Do you actually believe all of this shit?
All right. So this is going out. If there's any mediums listening to this season 2, we need a medium so Elgin can get Reverend Moon on the podcast. The Father God.
Oh yes. That would be fucking hilarious.
all right, my dude, it's been so great talking to you. Do you want to plug anything before we get out of here?
I would just say, listen to the podcast Falling Out, anywhere you pod, My website is fallingoutpod.com. All the episodes are there. Shortly, it's going to have portraits of all the participants, including the illustrious Ares Meyer. It's not up yet, but check it out there. I would say, okay, so the last episode of season one is coming out on April 20th. So listen to that. I think it's a really important one. And
shout out Jen Kieba.
Yeah, exactly. Season two is coming. So I'm of two minds here. I don't want to pigeonhole myself, but in principle, okay, don't hold me to this.
Famous
in
last
theory,
words.
If everything goes well, season two will be launching 6 p.m. GMT or British summertime, 6 p.m. on the 6th of June, the 6 months. And that is intentional.
Six.
Your numerology but don't hold me strong. I know, right? but don't hold me to it because you know, like I said, I'm new at this. I'm still figuring shit out. But that's what I'd like to do. Got a lot of work to do between now and then. But I would say if you've enjoyed season one of Falling Out, season two is gonna be like kind of next level in terms of just kind of where it goes. It's gonna go a lot of different places. And also actually the number one thing I would say is like just share it with people. Just set if people are in the church or in some other, you know, cultic group, just send them a link, fallingoutpod.com. That's all you gotta do. Everything is there. Subscribers help, reviews help, all that other stuff, but I'm not really in it for that. I'm in it for the changing of the lives. And if you need to do that incognito, then send them the link so that they can just listen to it themselves and make up their own minds.
All right. Thank you so much, man, for sharing. If you can, go to my podcast, give me a like and subscribe, maybe a little comment on Apple Podcasts. Yeah. Thank you everybody for listening. Love you. God save the queen. See you later.
Thanks, man. Talk to you soon.